Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, one and all. Thank you so much for joining us on Tricia's True Crime Radio. My name is Tricia Griffith. My co-host and producer is Kimster. She is working furiously behind the scenes to make sure everything runs smoothly tonight. And tonight, Tricia's True Crime Radio is brought to you by Canines with a Cause. This is a nonprofit organization with the mission of helping shelter dogs find homes by training them to work as companion and therapy and service dogs for veterans in need. You should check out their website. It's caninswithacause.com. Okay, here's the deal. I had a really funny, at least I thought it was funny, me anyway, I had a really funny opening for the show tonight. I was going to comment on the fake girlfriend of the young, naive football star. That's all changed. We're not even going to go there tonight because of the news that has come out today. I feel like I have been hit in the face with a grand size, grand jury, grand slam breakfast of information that is so shocking, it literally took my breath away when I heard about it. I'm talking about the fact that in 1999, the prosecutor for Boulder, Colorado, in the JonBenet Ramsey case, Alex Hunter, stepped outside the grand jury room after the grand jury was done investigating the Ramseys and said there would be no indictment. That's all he said. Said nothing else other than that. Everybody assumed that the grand jury voted not to indict. I assumed he didn't ask the grand jury to vote. It never occurred to me what the real truth was. We found out today the truth is the grand jury voted to indict John and Patsy Ramsey for child abuse resulting in the death of JonBenet. Hunter, being as cowardly as he can be, came out, and I feel he lied. He lied through omission. Rather than saying, yes, they voted to indict, but I feel the evidence is not there and it's not a winnable case. I can understand that. May not agree with it, but I can understand it. But to leave us 14 years with the impression that the grand jury did not vote, that voted not to indict, is horrific in nature. And we're going to get to all that a little bit later on in the show. But tonight we have a very special guest. I am so excited to have this man on. Rick Baker has written a book. It is an amazing book called No Goodbyes, The Mysterious Disappearance of the McStay Family. Rick is also a member of Web Sleuths. And Rick Baker, thank you so much for joining us tonight on Tricia's True Crime Radio.
My pleasure, Tricia. This is a treat for me. It's an honor. Thank you for allowing me to be here.
Wow. You know what? I'm going to record that and play it over and over and over. You're the first person that said that. Okay.
You're a legend, girl. You.
Oh, that's pretty scary. Anyway, a legend of what? That's what I want to know. Okay. Now, the McStay case is a very – all cases are emotional, but this one has really brought out a lot of people who are angry, who there's lots of accusations flying all over the place. You know, we're going to keep it nice. We're going to keep it very adult tonight. We're not going to get into all of that, you know, behind-the-scenes crap that happens on Facebook and on Twitter and sometimes on Web Sleuths. We're going to stick to the facts of the McStay case. There's Joseph, Summer, Gianni, and Joseph Mateo. Is that how you pronounce his name?
Yes, huh?
They literally vanished February 4th, 2010, from their home in Fallbrook, California. Rick Baker, you have devoted a lot of time and energy writing this book that is going to be available very shortly on Amazon, No Goodbyes, The Mysterious Disappearance of the McStay Family. Let's start with the basics here briefly. Tell us about this case. What are the facts of the case as we know them?
Well, I think probably your listeners are maybe even more well aware of the facts than I am. You know that on February the 4th, the family just disappeared that night, and they were having a normal day, and all of a sudden, you know, someone sees a surveillance tape from across the street, the troopers driving away, and then they're gone. And you know, from that point on, how I got involved in it was, you know, my wife and I moved to Fallbrook, which is where this happened, in March of 2010, just about 3 weeks after they disappeared, first part of March. And I was there to finish up my second book and hang by the beach and get out of Colorado cold and that sort of thing. And everybody in the coffee shop I was at in this little main street, Fallbrook, was talking about this family, you know, that disappeared. And so I kind of got infatuated with it and then, of course, became addicted after I interviewed Mike on my radio show. But those were the beginning stages. And, of course, all that we knew at that point was that there was a video that was probably them crossing a border. The trooper was found down by the border. For some reason, they just decided to bail, you know, leave everything behind, and now they're in Costa Rica sipping margaritas. So that was kind of the way this whole thing started. But a lot of your members, a lot of the sleuths around the country, especially those on your site, have been digging, you know, for years. And then, of course, there's a lot of information in the book that shows that it just wasn't a family, I don't believe, that just decided to leave one night, leave everything behind, and cross the Mexican border.
And you mentioned about the members of Web Sleuths helping. That's true. If you want to disappear and it turns into a true crime case, forget about it. The members of Web Sleuths will find you. They are truly
amazing.
Great.
They are relentless. They really are.
I know. And it's relentless in a good way. I agree.
Oh, yes.
Now, let's talk about the background here. There are some really colorful characters. There is a lot of shady, kind of scary things happening with this family. Now, Summer, the wife, she seems to kind of be, I don't want to use the word target, but she kind of seems to be the one that people are focusing on. She had a lot of stuff going on. Tell us about Summer. That's the wife and the mom in this case.
Right. Well, Summer, you know, Summer was, in my investigation when I first started, I guess for the listeners who aren't aware, I started writing the book in 2011. I actually wrote the book, and I started with Patrick McStay, Joseph's father. And I realized, you know, Patrick McStay was giving me some emails that he had given to him that were from Joseph's account and Summer's account. And the deal that Patrick and I had is I would write this book. He would furnish me with the information. I began to realize when I was almost done writing it with him that he was withholding a lot of the emails from Summer, personal emails that Summer had sent to her sister, her brother, co-workers in Phoenix, up north of San Diego, friends, although she didn't have many friends. I realized that he was withholding those. And I think probably in defense of Patrick, he was doing that because he likes Summer and didn't want me to see a side of Summer that, you know, was not pleasant.
Right.
I would call her, I would say that she is emotionally or mentally unstable. She was the exact opposite of Joseph based upon all of the emails and all of the people I talked to, you know, her associates, her friends, her coworkers, family. Same thing with Joseph. Those who hadn't really talked to the media did talk to me. I've kept them out of the book. I haven't quoted them because I promised I wouldn't, and I've honored my word. But, you know, Joseph, the laid-back surfer dude, easygoing. If you wanted to crash on his couch, he'd let you. If you needed to borrow some money, he'd lend it to you. Non-confrontational. Just wanted to live his life. A great father, wanted to be a good husband. Summer, on the other hand, very sketchy, a scary person when you begin to look at the emails that she had sent out. And I know that there are some on Web Sleuth, Tricia, who have said that they've seen all of these emails. And I know that they haven't. And the reason I know that they haven't is because some of these people are still out there saying that, you know, they think I'm giving Summer a bad rap or anyone who comes down on Summer, because they've seen the emails and she's not as bad as I'm saying that she is. That proves to me that they've never seen the emails, because if they had seen all the emails, they would never say that she was a good mother and a good wife. Any mother or wife who would do what she did to Joseph's three kids is a scary individual. Some have called her a monster. So I know that when someone says they've seen all of Summer's emails and they still support her, I know they haven't.
You have
a very scary person.
Now let's kind of throw in on this. First of all, I just want to say, you know, sometimes the truth is ugly, and we just got to deal with it. And in a case like this, you know, all bets are off. We got to know everything to find this family and find out what happened to them. Now, you're talking about Joe's kids from another woman, another marriage, right?
His son from his first wife, yes.
Right. What did Summer do that to these children that makes you feel that she is just this horrible person, basically. What? Give us an
idea.
And
there are
emails.
Well, there are some things that I purposely kept all of those emails out of the book. These are minor children. I don't want their innocence. All three of them are the innocents. I don't want to hurt them in any way, so I have completely refused to discuss them. And I can't now, Tricia, because they are minors and because they are innocent. You know, I haven't mentioned his name. I'm not going to, because it's not about them. You know,
no, but can you tell us what Summer did? I mean, what caused you to give us an example of what caused you to come to this conclusion about Summer?
All I can say in deferring that question, all I can say is it was the way that she treated Joseph's three kids.
And those are and two of those kids are hers, right?
Yes.
Right. Okay. And so she did something pretty awful, and I understand you don't want to, especially there's one child here where we know where he is, and I'm sure he appreciates you not bringing that up.
Well, you know, it's one. I guess if I went further with trying to answer, because I want to answer your question, but at the same time I don't want to hurt anyone. It would be specifically what Summer did to keep Joseph's firstborn out of his life. What the extent, the extremes to which Summer went to attempt to destroy any relationship that he had or wanted to have with his son from his first marriage.
Boy, that's just awful. You know what? You're painting a picture of Summer, and I know women like her, and they are scary, and they are definitely monsters. But here's the big question. Does Summer's personality and does Summer's actions in these areas have anything to do with the disappearance? What do you think?
Well, you know, and this is interesting, Tricia. The other night, after I'd done an interview in Albuquerque on an ESPN radio station of all places, I got a phone call from a man who was Summer's boyfriend in 1994, 95, and part of 1996. And that was kind of a hole, kind of an area that was a void with myself and the investigators in this, to try to figure out exactly what Summer was doing in those years. We didn't have a lot of emails to prove. A lot of the people that I talked to, they started in 2000, 2001. So that was kind of a hole. So I talked to this man for a couple hours. I've talked to him twice now. And he told me that on his very first date with her, now it was a blind date. He met someone in business and said, you've got to ask her out. He asked her out in 1994. He took her to dinner. The very first thing she did while they were eating dinner was break down and cry and say that her brother had just been killed in a car accident the day before. And she was hysterical and in tears, and he was obviously, he felt so sorry for her and the sympathy. Well, then he came to realize after he dated her off and on in the next number of months that she completely fabricated that.
Oh,
and
my
he
God.
Told me stories about what she had said in those two or three years that were just that bizarre. And he said she was so good at playing me in a number of different areas that I won't go into now because he asked me not to. And it took him 2.5 years or so to realize not only is she trying to play me, but I believe she's dangerous. And he said, once I heard that this family McStay disappeared, he's still in the Southern California area. He said, I didn't pay any attention. I didn't know who this person was. But then I looked at the picture and I saw the videos and I said, that's the Summer that I dated. That's the person who I dated. So he found a way to get a hold of me. We've talked, you know, extensively. And he painted a picture of this woman from 94, 95, 96, where he finally severed all ties with her because he said, you know, she scared me. Is she capable of killing Joseph or having him killed? He said, absolutely. Did she? We don't know. It's a true mystery. But she was capable, certainly in his eyes as well.
Well, that is very interesting that now people are starting to come out, and I feel very strongly that they will continue to come out and hopefully fill in pieces of this puzzle that has been going on for 3 years. We're talking with Rick Baker. Rick has written a book called No Goodbyes, The Mysterious Disappearance of the McStay Family. And Rick, Summer... let's talk a little bit. First of all, we have a question, okay? And I want to get to this question before we go on any further here. Okay, let's see. Where did it go? It disappeared. Here we go. Mike McStay, Now, that is
yes.
Joseph's brother, correct?
Yes.
Do you think he's suspicious or involved, or what is your thoughts on him?
Absolutely. In fact, Mike McStay is the reason I became addicted to this case. You know, after I'd heard about it for months in Fallbrook, I ended up with a talk show in San Diego. It wasn't a big deal. It was something to do. You know, I wasn't paid for it. It was kind of a volunteer thing. But where I interviewed people like you're interviewing me tonight. It was fun. I enjoyed it. So I called Mike McStay, and I wanted to interview him on the show because this case just infatuated me. How can a family of four just disappear, right?
Right.
So I had him on my show, but what I didn't tell him, and actually haven't really announced this until right now, tonight, and I'm doing this because your members of Web Sleuth are skilled and talented in investigation, and they need to know this. I spent a couple of hours on the phone the morning before I interviewed him on my show that afternoon with someone who was, in a way, involved with law enforcement. They're not law enforcement, but they were associated with the case for a short time and law enforcement. And I spent a couple hours on the phone with this individual. And this individual said, these are some questions you need to ask Mike when you get him on your show. And I said, okay, what are they? He said, ask him about the computer that he took from Joseph's home. That nobody really knows exactly how long he had the computer. Ask him about that computer and why he took it, and was it okay with law enforcement, with the sheriff's department? So that was one of the questions. There were some others as well. So I asked him that question on my show, and, of course, I still have the recording of it. And he said, you know, the sheriff's department, his quote was, the sheriff's department said that I could take the computer because I'm Joseph's brother. Now, what happened, in fact, according to the individual I talked with who was involved with the case for a short time and had a conversation with law enforcement, once law enforcement realized that Mike McStay had Joseph's computer and had taken it, removed it from Joseph's home, law enforcement said, go get the computer now or face arrest. So he went and got the computer and returned it. The question then is, as far as, you know, what you said to start this segment, is he part of this? Yes. I mean, he is, because Joseph had a habit of emailing to himself all of his passwords. So don't do that, ladies and gentlemen, and probably your members at Web Sleuth won't do that, but he had a habit of doing that. So anybody who would get his computer, and it could have been the night of the 4th when they disappeared, it could have been the 6th that weekend. I talked to neighbors who saw a white truck in the driveway the weekend of the 6th, the 7th. And it could have been, I don't know if that was Mike's truck, I don't know who it was, but I talked to neighbors who ID'd that. But anybody who would get on Joseph's computer had access to all of his bank accounts, all of his transactions, basically his life, because he was so trusting. Some would say he was naive, I don't think so, he was just trusting. So Mike had the computer that had all of the passwords, and oddly enough, money started getting transferred out of Joseph's accounts just a few short days after they disappeared. So absolutely, I believe Mike is culpable. You know, on my blog, Tricia, I have 15 questions, because Mike wants to write a book. I think he should. I have 15 questions to help him with this book that he needs to answer, because there are certain ways that, you know, if your brother went missing, I don't know if you have one, Tricia, or my brother.
I do. I would, I'd move heaven and earth. You couldn't stop me from looking for him.
And there are so many things that Mike did wrong, not just lied about, but did wrong from the very beginning, that you have to, you know, if you follow the money, which was what we're taught to do, then you start following that money. There are a lot of questions that Mike should have to answer. And I asked him those questions once I started on the book. You know, he hung up on me, he doesn't want to talk to me anymore, doesn't care for me now, but that's okay. These are still questions he needs to answer.
And that when somebody does that, you know that you've hit their red hot button, and that's what you want to do. But let's talk about this. Joseph's brother Mike, so he took the computer and found the passwords and took the money. Could he just be a thief? Could it have nothing to do with this? Why does this connect to their disappearance?
Well, and that question you asked is absolutely correct, Tricia. He could just have been someone who took Joseph's money. You know, my questions at that point would be, if he took the money, is he going to give it back to Joseph if Joseph shows up again? Right. Did he take the money because he knows Joseph isn't coming back? Or what about this? Why, again, if this is you and I, Tricia, and I have access to my brother's account such as that, I'm going to do it the legal way, number one. But I would, instead of taking all of that money out of Joseph's account and put it into my personal account, or my business account, which is what Mike did, wouldn't you and I take some of that money and put it up for a reward?
Oh, yes. That would be the first thing
I'd
do.
You know, there's been, Mike has never offered a reward. Mike has never offered one penny out of his own pocket or out of Joseph's money as a reward to find his family. So it doesn't prove that he had anything to do with the disappearance. But there are so many questions, Tricia, because why would you start taking money so quickly out of your brother's account mm-hmm. when he's only been gone a week or so?
You don't know if he's coming back, you know, unless
yeah,
you
I mean,
do
you
know.
You would do that maybe if you knew he wasn't coming back,
right.
Maybe you'd start hitting it up.
So, okay, this sounds like a Lifetime movie of the week. We have Summer, the wife and mother, who is this liar, storyteller, almost, sounds like a borderline personality type person, creating drama and causing problems wherever she goes. You have the brother of the missing husband, Mike, who takes a computer and takes his brother's money. Are those two connected in some way with the disappearance? Were they close? Were they friendly? Do you know how their relationship was?
They hated each other based upon the emails and everybody I talked to. They just don't care for each other. You know, a number of emails that Mike sent to Joseph after Joseph, quote-unquote, disappeared, and to others was, you know, be careful, Summer's dangerous, she's trying to poison you, she's trying to kill you, and she's lied about her age, and on and on and on. And,
right.
You know, I know that Mike did not care for her. She didn't care for him because, according to Summer's sister, who I had long conversations with, Mike made it a point to go to the house to try to borrow money from Joseph often, and Summer had finally had enough of that. She'd had enough of him coming to the house trying to borrow money, according to, you know, Summer's sister. These long conversations, Summer would talk to her sister and say, I've had just about enough of this. So I think, based upon the evidence that I've seen, they do not like each other, did not like each other. And I just can't – I know some have posed the theory that they were having an affair and they did this together. I don't see any evidence, running toward that.
So there's all now you can just let your mind run wild with all kinds of theories. Did Summer have something to do with the disappearance? Did Mike find out about it but is afraid to say anything, but he took his brother's money? Since they didn't like each other, it's unlikely that they were in on it together, if that's the case. Again, so many unanswered questions. We're talking with Rick Baker. Rick has written a book, No Goodbyes, The Mysterious Disappearance of the McStay Family. Summer, the mother and wife, she did lie about her age big time, didn't she?
Oh, yeah. She, depending on who you talk to, she just had an issue with that. I've talked to a number of women who understand that and have met maybe women such as that. For whatever reason, she had a low self-image. I don't know what her childhood was. I'm not a psychoanalyst. But going all the way back to her ex-boyfriend that I spoke with who dated her from 94 to the first part of 96, it was certainly then as well. And she's just someone who I don't believe was comfortable in her own skin. She burned and torched bridges instantly with her family, with business associates, with friends. She had no relationship skills, but she was a very dark person. And you would wonder, like this her ex-boyfriend told me, I always wondered when she looked at me what she was really thinking. And, you know, I put in the book, in the center of the book, Trisha, I have some color pages. There are some portraits there that the family went and had taken a few years before this disappearance. And I got permission from the photographer, who's since been out of business, to publish those. And one of those pictures, the look on her face as she's there on a rock on the beach with Joseph, just the look on her face, you wonder what she's thinking.
Really? Oh, that you've got to get the book just to see that picture. That sounds absolutely fascinating. Well, Summer does not come across as a good person in your book. Some of the things I'm going to throw out here, let's see, name changes, drugs, lying, fake college degrees, fraudulent insurance policies, all of these things are swirling around Summer, right?
She didn't have much integrity. And she wasn't concerned about that. It was pretty much all about Summer. Was she a good mother? Did she love her kids? And was she a great mom? I can't answer that, yes or no. I can't say definitively yes based upon the emails that I've seen, that a couple of other people have seen, but very few people have seen, that show her, I can only describe her as a monster because of the way that she treated Joseph's three kids.
Oh, that is just so awful. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about Joseph's family. We talked about his brother Michael. You started working out with Joseph, working on the book with Joseph's father, Patrick McStay. What happened?
Well, I did. You know, after I had Mike on the show that day, that fateful day, when I became addicted to the case,
mm-hmm.
I had a number of emails after the show because people, I think it had been posted on the Facebook pages that I was interviewing Mike, so it went all over the world. And I had a number of phone calls from people saying, you need to contact Joseph's father, Patrick, because you're going to get a different side of this case from Patrick than what you heard today from Mike. Because quite frankly, Mike did not tell the truth very often in my interview.
Mm-hmm.
And so I called Patrick. I didn't know Patrick. I didn't know anything about him. We started talking, and one thing led to another. He said, I'd like to write a book. And I said, okay, but if you write a book, you can't keep any of the money. Makes it look like you're profiting off your son's disappearance. So let's start the McStay Foundation, which I founded and I funded, me, Rick Baker, personally. And then we'll write this book. And so that's when we got into, as I mentioned earlier, the emails. He said he had this information. Somebody had given him the emails. Patrick probably still believes that he has all of them, and he doesn't. You know, he just doesn't. But he started giving me these emails, and we ran into issues immediately. You know, Patrick's he's certainly set in his ways, and he has his own opinion. And he thought things happened, events occurred that didn't. And that was because he was 2,000 miles away, maybe. You know, as far as the facts that he gave me, a lot of them did not pan out. When I went out and started investigating, since I lived there in Fallbrook, the first thing I did was go and talk to all of the neighbors, nine different neighbors. Two of them had moved away. I was able to talk to them, trying to get an understanding, you know, of what happened. And then I went and talked to family. I talked to Summer's family. A lot of Joey's friends would not talk to me at that point. They have since, but they wouldn't then.
Mm-hmm.
But I began to see very clearly that Pat, I believe Pat had an agenda. Yes, he loves his son, and I know that he has done what he feels is the best he can do to try to help find his son. He has become at times very hostile and very toxic, and he has torched bridges with everyone, including law enforcement, who will never talk to him again. And
mm-hmm.
I've got in the back of the book, you know, the complaint that he filed with law enforcement and how he was kind of beat down on all of that. So, and in a way, my heart goes out to Patrick because I know he loves Joey and Joseph,
mm-hmm.
and I know that he loves Summer, even though he probably doesn't know the extent of Summer because he's never read those emails. So I ended up having to sever all contact with Patrick when I wrote a chapter of the book, chapter 18, that he didn't like.
Mm-hmm.
And the deal was that we had that we would both sign off on the chapter. I would send him a chapter. He would look at it. If he wanted to make changes, he'd make them. I'd send it back to him. So I'd done that 17 times before. We both signed off on the chapters, number 18. He didn't like it. I had to publish it. I said, we can't put this in the book without it. And he blew up and hung up on me. And it was just terrible behavior on his part.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the end of our relationship. From that point on, now, of course, he doesn't like me either, you know.
But you're not making any friends, are you?
but it's very sad because Pat doesn't get along with Mike, and Mike, you know, didn't have anything kind to say about his father on the radio show, and I asked him
right.
all kinds of questions about Patrick. So you have those two factions in this case, Trish. If everybody could get together, if everybody would have gotten together, and I said, I'm writing a book, I'm not keeping the money, let's get this out for publicity. That's the
mm-hmm.
only reason I'm doing this, and to help Texas EquiSearch, but that's the reason, is to renew interest in this. If everybody had come together and said, okay, Rick, you write the thing, we will give you all the information we possibly can to try to locate our family, it would have been so much easier. But there are all of these factions. And then, of course, you have, as you and I were talking off the air, you have people who line up on both sides. And, I mean, it's just absolutely crazy.
It is. And after all these years, it still is crazy, and people are still going nuts about it. And you have factions that believe one thing, and they believe so strongly about it, and by God, they're going to get out there. They're going to trample on anybody who disagrees with them, I know.
Well, you know they are, and And Tricia, just to insert real quick, I see one of the questions. I'm on your site. One of the questions from Wendy101 says, so if they were warning Joey about Summer, why are they covering for her now? And I think that's a great question because they didn't really know, I don't think, the extent of Summer's dysfunctionalism or mental instability. They had never read these emails. I believe Pat has read some of them. Yes, I know he has. But he hasn't read all of them. And Mike hasn't read all of them either, I don't believe. Now, they just didn't understand the extent. You know, Summer's family knew that she had issues, but I don't think anybody understood the extent. You know, Joseph had talked to a couple of his friends that I spoke with that they were having serious marital problems. He was very concerned. Mm-hmm. But Joseph wasn't the kind of guy to go out and start talking to his friends about his marriage, you know, having problems. He was a stand-up guy. He has all kinds of integrity. So, you know,
Oh, are you there?
I'm here. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay. Oh, I'm okay.
I lost you for a minute.
Yeah, you just all of a sudden it's you floated away. It was very strange.
Okay, yeah, I'm back now. I'm here.
Does Summer have any other children other than the two with Joseph?
Not that we have seen. Not that we know.
Okay.
I asked her boyfriend, her ex-boyfriend, that, and I had a long conversation with her ex-husband, and according to them, no. But I don't know. I don't know.
Okay. Somebody is asking, what purpose would Patrick McStay have in withholding these emails? And I think we went over that. Basically, he's trying to protect his family, right? Because these emails are not pretty.
I think so. I think that, you know, he had some of the emails that were just, I mean, these were terrible emails, Tricia. I learned new four-letter words reading these emails. it was terrible. Patrick has not seen the emails that I'm talking about, which go a step far beyond the ones that he didn't want me to see. So I think he was trying to protect that. Absolutely. Who wants to have their family dirty laundry, so to speak, aired, right?
Yeah, true. Nobody does. It's
nobody wants.
It's horribly unpleasant. Let me ask you this about the emails. Your book, you have admitted tonight, you did not put in all the emails in your book, correct?
Yes, that's correct, yes.
Okay, so here's the thing, Rick. You're putting a lot of your theory out there on these emails that we haven't seen. And so I guess I don't know what I'm asking, but can you see how that might be problematic
absolutely.
For some people?
I battled with that with the individuals who came back with these emails and allowed me to see this cache of information that hadn't been seen. I battled with that, and I determined that the emails that I did put in the book painted enough of a picture of Summer that people would look at her as a person of interest. Did she do this? I have no idea. I've said, obviously, that I think she did based upon the emails just in the book, the way that she has treated people, the way that she acted, her lack of integrity, her lack of morality in so many ways. I felt like those emails were plenty because they're really very unsettling, as they are. You know, my publisher, when I sent those to him, said, you want us to publish these? And I said, absolutely, because of the foul language and the hurtful, terrible things that she said to Joey and to others. And Joseph would reply back, why would you say that to me? Why would you talk to me? Why would you treat me that way? Because he's just a stand-up guy. He would never treat anyone that way.
Right.
So there are more, yes. But in order for me to have released those, I would have been hurting innocent people. And those emails deal specifically with the way she treated Joseph's three kids, a large batch of those in her strategy and what she did to try to destroy any relationship with Joseph's first son.
Okay, that makes sense and totally understandable. We have a question from Tara Bull, and she writes, my inquiring mind wants to know if Rick has been able to snoop around, I'm not sure how to pronounce this, Amberes
Key. Yes,
yes,
I have. I actually have a friend down there who owns, I have a friend, Bill who owns the Four Seasons Resort on the Key. And I was down there. Joseph owns some land down there.
What interest of the case does this have with the case?
The interest would have been probably terrible as asking that question, because if he has land down there, is that where they went? Mm-hmm. When they left, was that them on the video? Did they go through Mexico? Did they drive all the way down? They were in Merida. Was that them there? And from Merida, they're 3 hours to Belize. They're a quick puddle jumper to the Key, and he's got property there. The property he has there is in a very remote area. I've been there. It's very difficult to get to. If anybody was building anything or living there, it wouldn't be known at first. It's almost, you have to kind of get there by boat is the easiest way. He has not been there, according to those who own the coffee shops there. And Bill Wilkerson owns the Four Seasons Resort. He's been there 30 years. He knows everybody on the island. Yes, terrible. Great question, because I thought that too when I went down.
Right. Very interesting. I didn't know he had had land down there. Okay, let's get back to the emails for one moment. But first, I just want to tell everybody we're talking with Rick Baker, a member of Web Sleuths, and I'm delighted that he's on the show tonight. He's written a book.
No, it's called, my pleasure.
Mine. The book is No Goodbyes, The Mysterious Disappearance of the McStay Family. And Rick, let's talk about those emails. You've said you've seen them. Do you feel that there is a chance, and this comes from the chat room, one of our questions, the emails could have been doctored before you saw them?
Absolutely no chance. They were proven to be accurate with the full header. There was no doctoring. And, of course, that again, comes from someone. And there are a number like this individual who are supporting Summer. They're not happy with me because I say that I call Summer a monster.
Mm-hmm.
But this is based upon it's based upon emails that they've seen, and they think that they've seen them all, and they haven't.
Got it.
And there's no copy and paste. I mean, these are accurate emails. These were verified, and I actually talked to a couple of the people that the emails were sent to, and they had the email that she sent them.
Mm-hmm. So you feel very confident. That's good to know.
Every one of the emails that I have that I didn't publish, and every one that I did put in the book, are 100% verified. Absolutely, yes. Good question.
We have time for a few more questions here, and this comes from our chat room. Who is, now I just lost it again, come on, where did it go, where are you, here it is, Chase Merritt, and who is he, and is he a person of interest?
And that's an interesting question. I promised Chase, I had long conversations with Chase. You know, he has turned down thousands of dollars to appear on these TV shows that probably Mike hasn't. And I promised Chase, he actually said, Rick, I don't want my name in your book. And I think his name is in the book twice.
Mm-hmm.
I devoted a chapter to him because I believe he was one of the ones who was hurt the most. He was he worked very hard with Joey and the fountain business, and he was making some pretty good money. He was
the fountain business
that Joey was in.
Okay.
You know, and so I spent a lot of time on the phone with Chase. I did not meet with him personally. He wouldn't talk to me when I was in California. Now we're on the East Coast. We talked, and we talked extensively. And you know, he told me all about what they did that day on Thursday. A lot of information that had never come out anywhere. He told me about the conversations he had with law enforcement, how they at first thought he was a person of interest, Tricia, and they asked him to take a lie detector test immediately. And he said, I'm not going to do that, and I don't blame him. But finally, after talking to his attorney said, you've done nothing wrong, so he did, and he passed the test. You know, Mike was asked to take the test, according to Chase and law enforcement, and he didn't. He refused.
Wow.
But Chase passed. I think he was probably had more to lose than anyone else. And I don't see him as a person of interest in any way. I think he was hurt the most. He did go to Saudi Arabia to install the fountain after Joseph disappeared. He finished the jobs that were started or going to be started. And then by about the end of April, first part of May, according to Chase, he was done. He walked away from it. He wanted nothing to do with it because Mike had taken Joey's company that had an A-plus rating on February the 4th and turned it into a rating of an F in about 3 months.
Oh, boy.
And Chase, you know, he was concerned about his reputation. He wanted nothing to do with it. He walked away from it. But a lot of the conversation we had, I promised him I would never go into. But basically, I think he was one of the ones who was hurt the most, yes.
We have a couple of other questions from the chat room. This is just so fascinating that I could go on all night. And I know we don't have that kind of time. But from, let's see, Ari McCurdy. If Summer killed her kids, what would the motive be? Just crazy, crazy woman who kills kids and then her husband? What do you think?
No, I have no idea. My mind, Trisha, just doesn't think that way. I mean, I believed and fought for Lance Armstrong, who for 10 years swore he never doped and sued anybody who claimed he did.
Right.
And I was saying, yeah, go get him, Lance. I believed him. And so my mind doesn't work that way, but how many times do we read that a mother has – it's hard for me to even say she killed her kids. As far as killing Joseph, what the motive could be there, I don't know that either. It's just really a true mystery. Was she capable? Yes. Everyone I talked to said yes. Did she? Can't prove it. But what is interesting, and I mentioned this on the blog, it came after the book, was that the end of November, a body was found east of Temecula, which is kind of north, about 20 miles north and east of Fallbrook, where they lived, 18 miles or so, a body was found. And I ended up getting on the phone with the Riverside County Coroner. She is a forensic anthropological coroner. I spent a lot of time with her on the phone. She examined the body. She did not have Joseph's dental records. I did. I had them given to me in the emails that I had access to. We had his dental records. So they were actually in Summer's emails, which was interesting. So I sent the dental records to her. She checked the body and realized, determined categorically it was not Joseph. But one of the first phone calls she told me that she received after she announced the body had been found was from the San Diego Sheriff's Department asking if the body was Joseph McStay.
Interesting. Very interesting. We have so many questions here. I'll try and get to as many as I can, people. Okay, let's see. They keep disappearing from my page here. I'm having all kinds of computer problems. Cadaver Dogs. This is from Wendy 101. Do you know if Cadaver Dogs ever went into Joseph and Summer's house? Were the walls painted? What do you know about this, if anything?
Were the walls painted or tainted? Did they say painted?
Were they freshly painted?
Part of them were, you know, MacGyver. I had a long conversation with MacGyver. He did paint some of them, but we don't know. I don't know about the cadaver dogs going in the house. Law enforcement has said that they had them in the backyard and around the property. You know, there was kind of a green belt area in the back of the property that was no longer a green belt. The way the rows of houses were built was there was another row of houses about 250 feet from their backyard that you would be facing that backyard. And in between those rows of homes was this green belt that at one time had landscape. You know, you could still see the sprinkler heads, but they kind of let it go and it was all dead. And I think from what I understand, they had cadaver dogs back in that area. Some of the walls, yes, were freshly painted in the home. MacGyver said that he did that.
Okay, there's somebody named Kavanaugh. Is it Danielle or Daniel?
Dan Kavanaugh.
Okay, Dan Kavanaugh. Was he ever asked to take a lie detector test? If he was, you know the results. And who is he and how is he connected to this case?
Well, we don't have enough time to talk about him. I've got a long chapter devoted to him in the book. He's kind of a dicey fellow. I talked to him for a long time. In fact, he wanted me to help him write his own book on trying to set the record straight. You know, I have no idea if he's involved in any way or if he just started – if he took the money or if the money was given to him. All in the back of the book, I have a lot of the PayPal receipts. We have a number that we didn't publish because we didn't need to. It's all the same thing. We don't necessarily know that Dan took the money himself or if Mike transferred the money to him. We don't know that. We just know that he was a recipient of over $10,000, between $10,000 and $20,000. He did tell me that that after the disappearance, Mike went out and started confronting and talking to a number of the clients that Joseph had out there who were still paying money. They hadn't paid off their second part of the deposit, maybe for their fountain. And Mike started intercepting that money, according to Dan. Instead of it being deposited in the Wells Fargo account or the PayPal account for Joey and his business, Mike started intercepting that. And, you know, Dan told me about all kinds of transactions. And we have some receipts for some of that. But, you know, Dan he's an interesting person, and he does not have much of a reputation with the ladies in San Diego. There's a website out there that's after him as far as, you know, a cheater and that sort of thing, dating, and all of these women have posted on there. I don't know if that's rumor or not, but he's an interesting person. In my book, I have a number of questions I asked him. He refused to answer any of them.
So you don't know if he took a lie detector test or not?
According to the ones I talked to, he was not asked to take one, but okay. I don't know. I do not know that.
Okay, I have two more questions here that we have to get to, that we'll get to. First one, this is an odd one, and I don't know what this means, but Hilda wants to know, Summer had Joseph dental records online. Is that what you said?
No, Summer had Joseph's dental records in her email account.
Email,
in one
okay.
of her email, yes.
Why? That's weird.
That's absolutely weird, isn't it?
Yeah,
but that's where we found them, in her emails.
Okay, let's talk. Let's wrap this up. And Rick, I would love you to come back maybe a little bit after the book has been out. And
anytime, it'd be my honor. This has just been a treat for me to be on your show.
Oh well, I have one more question here. I want to clear something
yes.
up. There's been some confusion with Texas EquiSearch. What
yes.
can you tell us about that? What's going on, and where do things stand now?
Okay, well, very quickly, the confusion probably started a number of months ago when I posted on WebSleuth from my blog. I think it was on WebSleuth that Mike and Patrick never paid Texas EquiSearch the $4,500 that they spent when Tim Miller and EquiSearch went out there and searched and looked and that sort of thing. That was my misunderstanding with Tim Miller. What I had done, Texas EquiSearch does not invoice anyone.
Right.
What I had done in my long conversations with Tim Miller is I said, okay, you spent money, right? And he said, yes. And I said, did you ever recover that? And he said, no. And I said, well, send me an invoice of how much you spent. It was my goal at that point, because I was still working with Patrick, and I had established the McStay Foundation. It was my goal at that point to reimburse Texas EquiSearch the money that they spent, because they work on donations. And so it was my bad, 100% my fault, that I posted that as an invoice. And I got in all kinds of trouble, I got to tell you, Tricia, with Tim.
Oh, I can imagine.
And the board. I mean, they were
right.
They were bursting the flames. So I walked that back very quickly, because I just didn't understand it. They do not ever bill anyone. He had sent me the number that they spent, and I was trying to get it reimbursed, which we're going to do now with these book proceeds. Secondly, when I said I want to donate all the proceeds somewhere, my first thought, because I've never written a crime book.
Mm-hmm.
This was not my expertise. And without the help of my investigators, I can tell you now, and all of your listeners, there would be no book. I never would have been able to do this. They have been invaluable, and I hate that I'm forefront, out front and center here. It's really not about me. I haven't done anything but put a few words down. It was all them. It wasn't me. But I decided to give all of the money to Texas EquiSearch. And I mentioned, I talked to one of the administrators there about it, and they said, great. Well, they didn't understand, because I didn't explain it well enough, exactly what I was going to do. Once I posted on my blog that all the money goes to them, somebody contacted them, which is fine, to confirm that. And then they, again, went crazy because they have a policy that states that they cannot take any money that's generated from an open case, quote unquote.
Mm-hmm.
So because this is an open case and all the proceeds from this book are, you know, from an open case, their board of directors, and they actually met and talked about this, they can't break their policy. It's set in stone. They can't take any money from an open case. So I said, okay, can I do this then? My foundation, can I personally write you checks that I would be donating the other way? Can I do this personally? And they said, absolutely. So the way it's set up now, and I have a check for about $1,000 that this week is going to go to them based upon the e-books that have sold off my site, almost $1,000, might be that by tomorrow or so, that I'll be sending to them this week. And that's the way we're going to do it, because that way they can keep their policy, and, you know, I don't infringe on that. So I'm fortunate that they're even talking to me still, Tricia, you know, because of the mistakes I've made. But I love these people. I love Tim. I am completely sold on exactly what they do, and I want to support them every way I can.
Well, that you are just trying to do a good deed, and I'm sure that I can't speak for Tim Miller, but I know he's a good guy, and I'm sure he can see that and he understands. So I'm glad that all of that was settled. Okay, Rick Baker, tell us the name of your book, when it will be available, and what is next in your life.
Well, it's called No Goodbyes, and it's on Amazon. It's on my site. On my site, I have the ebook and the book. If you buy it from my blog, then Texas EquiSearch gets more money. You're welcome to buy it from Amazon, which, Tricia, I'm humbled because right now on Amazon, the book is number 24 on the true crime list of 100, top 100, and that's out of about 5,000 books.
Wow.
And out of about 6 million books on Amazon, the book is ranked right now at 3,455 for a book that has not been released. And again, this isn't about me. It's all about the McStays.
Mm-hmm.
I'm out there, obviously, you know, giving interviews, but the publicity, Tricia, is fabulous. I was in Southport, North Carolina yesterday where there was a possible sighting. We had an incredible event, and we're going to do it again next week. More mm-hmm. people are going to come in the newspaper. So we're getting the case renewed and the interest, and we're bringing in, as you're doing on your site, so many more people who may have heard about it 3 years ago, and now they're back into this. That's the purpose of the book. Let's find Gianni and Joseph Mateo for sure. I think the world has fallen in love with them. We want to make sure they're safe.
Thank you. Thank you, Rick Baker. We will have you on again very, very soon. And thank you for all you're doing. You're doing an incredible job to help this family. And let's just hope and pray that something breaks very, very soon. Take care.
Thank you, Tricia. My pleasure. Thank you very much. Have a great night.
You too. Bye-bye. Kimster, my darling, are you there?
Yes, I am. How
okay,
are you?
I'm good. My computer is totally frozen. Can you put Cynic on the air for me? I can't get to the studio on my computer.
Cynic, oh, yes. I love Cynic. Hold on just a second.
Okay, Cynic, I know you have to run, but let's just kind of recap. First of all, a great interview with Rick Baker about the McStay family. Wow, I would highly recommend this book. I have read it. I'm not quite done with it yet, but it's pretty fascinating, and this is a wild case. Speaking of wild cases, the whole reason I got into the internet and true crime, JonBenet Ramsey, at the beginning of the show, I talked about the horrendous fact that we found out today, thanks to Charlie Brennan from his article online. It seems that the grand jury in 1999 did vote to indict the Ramseys in the death of their daughter. Alex Hunter never told us. He lied to us and said there will be no indictment. Well, that's true. There would be none because he refused to sign it, which is his choice, but he should have said, he should have had the courage to come out and say, yes, they indicted. No, I'm not going to sign it. Cynic is one of our incredible members of both Forums for Justice and Web Sleuths who's been following the case as long as I have. Cynic, your thoughts on this?
Oh, quite a few, as I'm sure many members of Web Sleuths do. Thanks for having me on, by the way, Tricia. I guess one of the questions I have is a bit puzzled as to why it took so long for all this to come out. I mean, obviously there's grand jury secrecy laws and so on that have kept a lot of people silent, and a lot of people are still silent. When they went to Beckner for comments, there was no comment citing grand jury secrecy, Hunter as well. So, I mean, that has, I guess, kept the lid on things for so many years, but, you know, 16 years later, it's somewhat intriguing that it's come out at this point. Kind of racking my brain trying to figure out why. Possibly, I'm thinking it may have been related to Kohler's book. Maybe it might have even spurred.
That's the only
know,
thing I can think
Brennan.
Of. Yeah.
Yeah. And I hope that Kohler sort of capitalizes on this because I think both of us have been a bit disappointed that he hasn't really done more media related mm-hmm. to his book. And this would be a great opportunity for him to get out there and, and to do that. It's inspiring, after all these years, there's been so much movement in the case with Jim Kohler's book and now with this, it's extremely encouraging, and I'm obviously very happy, as I'm sure many people are. Then on the other hand, of course, there's, you know, the anger aspect. I mean, a lot of people are, you know, as you mentioned yourself, extremely, you know, ticked at Hunter. And, of course, the classic questions come up. Is it, you know, was it cowardice? Was it corruption, incompetence, some combination of those three? You know, when you're discussing some of the Boulder district attorneys, I mean, these words, you know, I'm sure come up fairly frequently. And, you know, just trying to untangle which one of these is the main factor. I think the actually the interview with Bill Weiss, the assistant district attorney at the time,
mm-hmm.
there was actually a pretty good interview with him, and he revealed some interesting things too that were sort of touched on in the article. Remember the classic sort of conundrum that some people had with this case of you know, if there's more than one person indicted, or if the, you know, if the evidence points to more than one person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what do you do? I think Wendy Murphy famously said, try to find her quote here real quick. Wendy Murphy, it's why the JonBenet Ramsey parents are both free, because you can't try the father, he'll blame the mother. You can't try the mother, she'll blame him, so they both
mm-hmm.
walk. And that's more or less what Weiss said when he was asked about why didn't Alex Hunter sign the true bill, in other words, agree with the grand jury and then proceed ultimately to a prosecution of the case, which is what true bill means. Bill Weiss said that he mentioned two things. He said lack of evidence, but then right on the heels of that, he immediately went into this sort of long dissertation about, again, he said, when you have a true bill that says two people are involved, but it doesn't say what the involvement of the people was,
mm-hmm.
all a good defense attorney has to do is separate the trials, and all of a sudden you've got nothing.
Right.
And I think that, this really was a big, big factor in Hunter's decision.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yes, you could certainly argue the, you know, the corruption aspect, money talks, et cetera, and I'm sure that is a big factor. Along with the fact that, you know, it was also brought out in the Weiss interview that these people were just not used to prosecuting felons. They had no experience, and they were scared. And I can understand and appreciate that, too. But there's a way to get around, and I wanted to bring this up with Kohler last time, and one of these times maybe I'll get a chance to...
Cynic, hold on one second. We're talking about James Kohler. He is the former lead investigator in the Boulder District Attorney's Office in the JonBenet Ramsey case. He was so disgusted with what he saw, he wrote a book and basically spilled all the beans. So when we talk about Jim Kohler, that's who we're referring to. Okay, Cynic, go ahead.
Yes, see, what I really wanted to bring up was, several things I wanted to bring up with him, as I'm sure did Cold Case and others, but one of the things that I think he touched on in his book with respect to his theory of prosecution, and it goes back to the title of Kohler's book as well, referring to the kidnapping of
mm-hmm.
JonBenet Ramsey, and actually in an interview with... in another interview on the case, he had mentioned that when asked that question, well, why did you title it that way? He said that in his mind, there is evidence to show that what he feels, I believe, that the head injury to JonBenet occurred in the kitchen area, or on the first
mm-hmm.
floor of the home at least, and then she was taken downstairs and ultimately ended up in the wine cellar. As per the doctrine of kidnapping, it's a lot of people have the sort of movie concept of kidnapping, you know, the person gets tied up and, you know, the big ransom, et cetera, et cetera. But the actual law of kidnapping could apply in this case. And as Kohler mentioned in that interview, he said that if it could be proved that JonBenet was moved from one point in the home, for example, in this case, the kitchen, downstairs into the wine cellar, that would comprise kidnapping.
Yes.
And the reason I say that's important is that there's another law in place called felony murder in Colorado. Not all states have this particular concept of murder, but in Colorado they do. So you have your classic charge of, you know, murder one, murder two, et cetera. Then in the state of Colorado, there's this concept called felony murder. And what it essentially means is, let's say, for example, actually I'll read just a little section here. A rule of criminal statutes that any death that occurs during the commission of a felony is first-degree murder, and all participants in that felony or attempted felony can be charged with and found guilty of murder. And to give an example, say you have a robbery involving more than one criminal, in which one of them shoots, beats to death, or runs over a store clerk, killing that clerk. Even if the death were accidental, all of the participants can be found guilty of felony murder, including those who did no harm, had no gun, and did not
intend to hurt. Right. They were there. They participated. They can be charged, too. So this is what you're saying Alexander could have charged them with, basically.
Exactly. And this is not something that, you know, certainly I'm coming up with. It was in Perfect Murder, Perfect Town, the book.
Mm-hmm.
And in that book, it was indicated that people had, remember that dream team that was assembled by the Boulder Police Department to sort of help them with legal issues because they had no trust or faith in Alex Hunter and his team?
Mm-hmm. Right.
These people, again, came up with that same concept there. And as a matter of fact, Daniel Hoffman, this is mentioned in the book there, after that little presentation where Steve Thomas and the other detectives in the case made their, you know, sort of case for why the case should go to trial, Daniel Hoffman said, he was working pro bono for the police, as I mentioned, he said to Denver DA Bill Ritter during one of the breaks in this presentation, he said, "It looks like they've got it." "Got what?" said Ritter. "Felony murder," Hoffman said confidently. And Ritter didn't see it, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's one person, you know, again, in that legal team that saw it. Darnay Hoffman was a great proponent of that, the late Darnay Hoffman, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But he was also a great proponent of this. He thought for sure that this would have been the way to proceed because it removes that unfortunate tangle that happens when you don't know, you know,
who did what
and when. So, you know, and in this particular story that we've seen today, one of the things that they mentioned is that there was a 3-year statute of limitations on what the grand jury came up with. In other words, the Class 2 felony involving child abuse. And it's interesting that that grand jury, I believe, concluded in October of 99. So they only actually, if that wasn't filed promptly, it actually would have it would have exceeded the statute of limitations. They only had, I guess, until December of 99 to actually file that charge. Whereas, again, this particular concept of felony murder, as long as you could go down that path, there is no statute of limitations.
Exactly.
And that's why I believe that would be the way to go.
And I agree with everything you say. And, you know, as we mentioned earlier, Alex Hunter refusing to sign the indictment of the grand jury, the indictment of John and Patsy Ramsey and the death of their daughter, that's one thing. But not telling us. And here's the thing that just, I mean, I'm telling you, blood is spurting from my eyes. It is an ugly sight.
I completely agree.
And Lynn Wood went around saying the grand jury refused to indict. The grand jury refused to indict, you know, all over the world. And people would grab onto that and say, well, if they were guilty, the grand jury would have indicted. Well, guess what? They did. And surprisingly, Lynn Wood is not a peep from him. Don't hear him anywhere. And you're not going to see him anywhere. I promise you that. After Kohler's book and now this, Cynic, Lynn Wood is going to be far and away. And I'll write him, invite him on my show, and he'll ignore me as usual. But and finally, and I want to get to one other caller that we have here. Kimster, while I'm talking, can you put Cherokee on the air for me, please? Burke Ramsey needs to man up, for God's sakes. Just get over your dad and do the right thing. People, innocent people, including your sister, have been greatly hurt by all of this crap that has gone on. Okay? Just man up, Burke Ramsey, and come out and tell us what happened. Because your parents went around blaming everybody else rather than tell the truth, and people's lives were ruined. And Burke Ramsey has a chance now to do the right thing, to grow some balls, and to get out there and do what nobody else has done, and that's tell the damn truth. So, okay, I need to calm down. Sorry. Cynic, I know you have to go. Is there anything else you want to say before we wrap it up?
No, the rest would pretty much just be outrage. So, yeah, that's pretty much all I have to say. I just, as I say, on the one hand, there's that tremendous frustration and anger, but on the other hand, it's so encouraging to see that so many good things are happening in the Ramsey case.
That's true. We got to look at the bright side. There are some things happening. Cynic, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you, Tricia.
Take care. Bye-bye. And another person that has been with us since day one of this case is somebody who does amazing work in analyzing handwriting, and she is an absolutely amazing person, and that's Cherokee. And Cherokee, are you as angry as I am right now?
Yes, I am.
Okay, speak up and start yelling and swearing, please, so I don't feel so bad.
Well, when I first read the article that came out today, I was just beside myself, because as you said, we have been told over and over again by the Ramseys and their lawyers, they have flat lied to us, that they were not indicted. You know, I remember waiting for the grand jury thing to come out with that. I remember waiting for it to come out, what was going to happen, and Hunter came to the microphones and said, we're not going to prosecute. And it was such a letdown because everyone believed they were going to be indicted. And when it didn't happen, it was just kind of the air went out of the whole investigation. And I realized
we couldn't believe it.
No,
we couldn't, we couldn't
and I realized
believe
then
it.
The fix was in. There mm-hmm. was never going to be a prosecution case. There will never be a trial. There will never be anything that is going to show what really happened that night to JonBenet. And so I thought, okay, that's it. I'm going to quit following this case. But I couldn't. I could not mm-hmm. quit. And because of what I had seen, as you mentioned with the handwriting analysis, in the ransom note, with linguistic analysis also, that Patsy had written the ransom note, and that is exactly why I got involved in the case to begin with. I knew she was involved somehow, but I didn't know how. I just knew she wrote the ransom note. And I have gone through 100 different scenarios in my mind of what could have happened that night, but the one thing I knew was that Patsy Ramsey wrote the ransom note. So everything else they did and said was a lie. When they tried to distance themselves from the ransom note after it came out, when other people said, yes, her exemplars match people like Sina Wong mm-hmm. and Epstein and all those people said, then all of a sudden the Ramseys, you would have thought that ransom note didn't exist.
They never heard about it.
Never heard about it ever again. But they find some partial, degraded, not even a full complement of DNA on some of JonBenet's underwear, redressed underwear from a new package, never washed, and all of a sudden the Ramseys jump on that. Well, boy, did they luck out, because I guarantee if we had our clothes examined right now, we'd have all kinds of partial DNA from places where we have sat, people have touched, mm-hmm. all kinds of things. But they jumped on that as their get-out-of-jail free card. And then it went on, you know, that's all they would talk about, never the ransom note, never anything that linked them to it. They destroyed other people's lives, John Gigax, other people that they rolled the bus right over, you know, look at this person, that person, look at anybody but us. And that's the part that really angers me when I read this, is that they knew, they know what happened, and yet they persecuted other people to make themselves look good. And here's the
arrogance.
Part that really makes me angry. Yes,
exactly.
The self-righteousness. Yes.
The Ramsey, John and Patsy yes. Ramsey treated everybody else
yes.
like they were beneath them, and it
yes.
didn't matter that they destroyed their life, because
no.
we're talking about the Ramsey family, and they're more important, and
yes.
that is infuriating. John Ramsey is an Iceman, and I hope and pray that Burke has some semblance of a soul in him, and he will do the right thing. He needs to do the right thing.
He's not going to. He's not going to. He was raised in that. He knows nothing else. Let me get back to what I was going to say then before. I want to reiterate one thing that was said in the lawsuit, and then I want to go and say where that takes us and why I feel so much anger and why there is so much anger out there, and that that anger needs to propel us to demand Mary Lacey's head on a platter.
Okay,
and
what lawsuit are we talking about?
Okay, we're talking about the original indictment, the article that came out today, and it
the
said,
article. Okay,
the
let me
article.
Just tell you. Hold on, Cherokee.
Okay.
We're talking about an article by Charlie Brennan in the Daily Camera that says that reveals finally that the grand jury did indict John and Patsy Ramsey for felony child abuse in the death of their daughter. Okay, Cherokee, go ahead.
Okay. What I wanted to reiterate one of the sentences. It said one of the jurors told the camera, "We didn't know who did what. just like what I mentioned. You know, it was hard to separate because they never separated them and questioned them separately, and they didn't show up to talk to investigators till 4 months later, followed by their lawyers, and only answered the questions. So we know there was no way to tell because then they got their story, you know, put together. But anyway, it says, but we felt the adults in the house may have done something that they certainly could have prevented, or they could have helped her, and they didn't. Okay, right there, that throws the intruder out the window.
Exactly.
The DJ indicted to the Ramseys, and Hunter refused to prosecute because he was in bed with the Ramseys from the very beginning. There were phone calls made to him. His pal hadn't. They had all kinds of stuff on him that I'm not at liberty to say, Hunter. And he had to play softball with the Ramseys, and he couldn't afford it. He had to go through the motions of presenting things to the DJ, hoping they would indict, but guess what? They did. And then he had to turn around and not prosecute. He never, ever intended to prosecute the Ramseys. And that's why he went so softball. That's why he gave away evidence to their lawyers. And it is infuriating at this time to know there is two systems of justice in America. There's one for the rich and the powerfully connected like the Ramseys, and there's one for the rest of us. We wouldn't have been allowed to hide behind lawyers. We would have been drugged down to that police station. We would have answered questions, and it would have gone a totally different way. But the Ramseys got away with it because of their money and their connections. And here's the second thing I want to say from that article. This talks about Lacey's bogus exoneration of the Ramseys. Yes. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that in just a minute. But what is said is Weiss and Grant. Grant was a DA in the neighboring county right next to Bullock. It is more inappropriate than anything else, Grant said, of Lacey's exoneration. It is not a prosecutorial duty to exonerate people. It is a prosecutorial duty to seek justice and to prosecute the bad guys. If you don't have a bad guy to prosecute, don't exonerate people who are at least peripherally under suspicion. I don't think it was appropriate at all. No one has ever heard of a DA going around, calling a press conference, and presenting a get-out-of-jail-free card and the exoneration to people that are under suspicion, who are under that umbrella of suspicion. That has never been done. And you know what? Lacey got away with it. Nobody called her on it. Nobody said, no, you can't do that. And what happened to that is that stupid thing that she did got into the media, and so on every news article you read, everywhere, any report, oh, but the Ramseys were exonerated by DNA. It can't be. No, they were not. And here's the truth of that DNA. If you read Culler's book, and this is the book by James Culler that you mentioned, he talks about what really happened when that DA's touched DNA, and they went through, they found the DNA of five men and one woman, partial DNA. We're not talking full complements, 13, which you put into a database on, partial DNA of all these people on her clothing. She wasn't touched and handled and killed by that many people. If there's one intruder... So that brings into question the DNA that Mary Lacey is trying to say was the DNA of an intruder. I'm sorry, Lacey, that doesn't fly. And she knew there was more DNA than that one on there, and she knew they had been indicted. So here's what I have to say about it, and I've got this lined out also at Forums for Justice, where I post about it, and which is the complimentary forum that you have to Web Sleuth. And here's what I wanted to say. She knew all along that the grand jury voted to indict the Ramseys, and she still did her PR stunt of exonerating them with those questionable DA findings. She had no right to exonerate anyone, and that exoneration is not worth the paper that it's printed on because of the partial DNA was full of other people's DNA, too. It's not just one person. She tried to act like it was one person, an intruder, and that's why it exonerated the Ramseys. And she has completely screwed over the truth with that exoneration. And here's what happens. Just look what happened in this article. When they talked to Brian Morgan, when the people from Daily Caller talked to Brian Morgan, the Ramseys' former attorney, what does he say when they confront him with this, that the GJ indicted the Ramseys? What does he say? Does he answer the question? No. What he says is, oh, but they were exonerated by DNA.
Yeah,
which
is baloney.
It is baloney. It is bull. That's why they don't ever have to answer any questions. Oh, but they were exonerated. Oh, okay, well, I guess they must not have been guilty. No, and you know what? I feel, and there's other people that feel this strongly as I do, she needs to be criminally prosecuted.
I agree. Absolutely, she does.
For current investigation. Here's the deal, Tricia. If those Ramsey case files are being kept closed because it's an ongoing case, then she has interfered with the prosecution of that case.
Mm-hmm.
If it is not an ongoing case, Tricia, then open up those files and let us see for ourselves what the truth is. There's no two ways about it. There's no two ways about it.
No.
Either she, by her doing her, either they need to get rid of that exoneration and say, sorry, Lacey was out of line, the Ramseys are not exonerated, they're back under the umbrella, everything's, you know, back where it was, and this is an ongoing case, or they need to say, sorry, you know, she interfered with the prosecution case, we can't prosecute it, and they need to criminally prosecute her. Because
absolutely.
There's no other way. There's no other way. You cannot have it both ways, and that's what they're doing. And I cannot tell you how angry it makes me every time I read in any news media article or anything on the TV or anywhere else, well, the Ramseys were exonerated by DNA. No
one
ever called that up.
Jane Velez Mitchell says that. That infuriates me. She should know better.
Yeah, she should. She should. And no one in the media followed that up. No one checked it out. No one. What they do, it's all lockstep. You know, it's okay. No one investigates anymore. They just take it, whatever's off the news feed, and they run with it. So they all believe that Mary Lacy did her due diligence. She did real DNA investigation, and she, first of all, she was not in any position to exonerate them. I mean, that wasn't even valid to begin with. And secondly, her exoneration is totally worthless. It is based on her interpretation. She wouldn't even give the evidence when she said, and she wouldn't even ask any questions. After her PR stunt, she would answer no questions, and she would not release any of the DNA data. Well, if she's worried about what we're going to see, why did she do it? She should have been proud to release it. Here, look at this. This is why I exonerated them. Oh, no, it was all kept under wraps. I cannot believe everyone in Colorado let her get away with that. She should have been called on the carpet and said, Lacy, you had no business doing this. DAs do not exonerate people. And furthermore, what you based it on is totally bogus. And I'm sorry. I know I'm upset. And I shouldn't get.
Well, that's okay.
So
let me just.
When I think about it.
I know. Let me just tell you one thing.
Okay.
Here's the situation, okay? So many adults failed JonBenet Ramsey that they should be ashamed of themselves. And you're right. And that includes the mainstream media. They were in lockstep with Mary Lacy. The people who were not, forumsforjustice.org and websleuths.com. We are the only reason that stuff is that these facts are still out there. It's because we won't let it die, and we will not. And I am hoping that the people now that are in control of this, the adults, will say, I should have stood up then. I'm going to stand up now. We're going to hold a news conference, and we're going to say the exoneration does not stand. You know, mainstream media, erase it. The Ramseys are not exonerated. And we're going to tell the truth. I would love to, I wish I was an attorney so I could get a Freedom of Information Act request into them, because I would love to see the evidence that the Ramseys investigator had that everybody else has seen, except for the people that matter, that want to know the truth. There are so many things wrong with this case that we could go on and on and on all night long, and maybe someday we will. But Cherokee, I do need to wrap it up. I will say I invited everybody I knew on the show tonight, and thank you to the two people that showed up. I invited Kohler, Carol McKinley. Everybody was busy. I understand that it was short notice. I'm not saying that you weren't busy. I know you were, but I'm still going to hound you guys to come on my show to talk about this. Don't think that it's over, because it's not. Cherokee,
I have to say one more thing. Trisha,
okay.
It's because of you keeping Web Sleuth and FFJ alive. It is you that has kept us alive, and I am so proud to know you and so thankful that you have felt the need to keep. We are the only ones keeping the flame of truth alive for JonBenet. We are the only ones.
I know.
Everyone else has tried to erase it. The Ramseys have tried to walk. They walked out of that house and never went back, never turned around once, never looked back for that poor girl. And it would have been totally buried if people like you and Kona had not stood up and said, no, we will not be silenced. And thank you so much for providing us a voice to speak for JonBenet.
Well, thank you. You give me way too much credit, but thank you very much, and thank you for all you do. And we'll be on top of this. I'm hoping next week. I'll have some people on here that can address this further, and we can dig into this deeper. Cherokee, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Bye. Oh, Kimster, are you there?
Yes, I am. Am I here?
I am worn out. I am worn out from... I mean, I was so fascinated with Rick Baker, and then now the JonBenet case. It's just I'm pooped. I need to overeat. That's the answer. So as soon as I get off the air, that's what I'm going to do. Totally, completely overeat unhealthy food. That's the answer in a situation like this. Okay. Kimster, are you ready?
Yes, I am.
What
I missed
is,
you last week.
I know. I was not feeling well. That's what I need to do. I need to make up for all the meals I didn't eat last week. I'm going to do that tonight. That's what I'll do. Okay. Here it is. It is the Web Sleuth's hot cold case of the week.
Patricia, I was going to announce this last week, but we weren't here, so I just wanted to let our web sleuthers know. And by the way, for those of you who are not on websleuths.com, I am an administrator on there, so I tend to talk about web sleuths more than forums for justice, but
I
do
okay.
appreciate our sister forum very much. But I wanted to let everybody know that we've added someone to our mod squad, and that's Angel Online. She's helping members in the missing forum now. So if you see her in there, we actually got an angel going on in the mod squad now. So
cool.
It's been kind of fun, yeah. But part of the missing forum is the unidentified forum, and that's where our own Carl K., and then he's got some numbers after his name. That's where he resides. And, in fact, after hours and hours of detailed sleuthing, Carl K. and his team celebrated a match this week. And what a match is when they are able to identify unidentified remains, find out who they are, and send them home to their family.
That's
fall,
amazing.
Yeah, believe me, these guys are on our site every single day for hours and hours and hours, and Carl Kay is our moderator there. And last fall, they put together a female's remains with a missing woman named Karen Tate. And this week, they were able to confirm that information that we did make that match. And
wow.
She's on the front page at www.websleuths.com. You'll actually see her picture. And guess what? They also are now charging her husband with murder. And she was gone for 10 years. So
and Carl Kay and everybody that helped out, I want to say from my heart, thank you so much. This is absolutely amazing what you have done. And you deserve a lot of praise and a lot of thanks. That is great, Kimster.
Yeah, it is really, really awesome. And Tricia, did you know that Carl Kay does facial reconstructions?
No, I did not know that.
Yeah.
Can he do anything with my face? Can he make me look like, I don't know, Jennifer Aniston maybe? I don't know. Well, I'll talk to him
That's
later.
That's a great idea.
It
I
is.
Need to have him fine and put it on a singles website. That
there
ought
you go.
Be good.
There
All
you
right,
go.
Yeah. Yeah, but then you'll lose me because I'll marry some rich and famous guy. And
well, I did not know Carl Kay did that. So that is interesting stuff.
Well, actually, when everyone checks out this week's cold case, you'll get to see what he does because it's on the front page of Web Sleuths right now.
Oh, good.
So, yeah. So anyway, let's get going with our cold case. I've waited over a week now, not almost 2 weeks. So here we go. Do 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 do.
The horn. We're ready.
Andrea Doe. That's the name that the members of WebSleuths.com are very familiar with that frequent the unidentified forum. This young woman stepped onto Pacific Coast Highway on April Fool's Day of 1990. She was struck first by a Mazda MX-6 and then a Lincoln Continental. She died instantly. When a sketch of her was published in local newspapers, several Huntington Beach residents said they had spoken with her. Her first name may have been Andrea, and she may have been from the East Coast. She had no permanent home in Orange County, California. One of the people who had spoken with her said she claimed to be adopted and was trying to find her real family, and that's why she was in California. She said she was from somewhere like Virginia. And she told another person she was from New York. She claimed that she was 25 or 26, but she appeared that possibly she was as young as 16 years old, Tricia.
Oh, dear.
Andrea Doe, as we call her now, also spent a night at the home of a mobile home salesman who took pity on her, and he said that she had a few articles of clothing but no money. The family had fed her, gave her the back bedroom, and did give her some money. Andrea apparently took the money and bought clothes at a Goodwill store, including a pair of shoes for $19.95. I thought that was kind of weird for way back then.
Mm-hmm.
She was wearing these pink shoes with the price tag still on them when she was struck on the highway by the cars. She was wearing a black cotton dress, a red long sleeve shirt, fishnet stockings, pink sweater, and a size 40D bra. So I think she was, a little on the heavier side. In case you guys look at her picture, with a little robust there.
Mm-hmm.
A ring. This is an interesting part of the mystery. A ring of human hair was located on her left ring finger.
Oh, what? Oh, that is kind of weird.
That is. She carried a smooth black stone and a motel key inscribed with number 218. She had no identification or credit cards, of course. There is a member. So this is another interesting part. This is why you guys got to go check out the unidentified form. It's just a mystery of mystery after mystery. There's a member on websleuths.com who thinks she looks a lot like a girl named Andrea that he knew in Seattle in the mid-'80s. And so we're kind of wondering if this member that calls himself Montana Man on websleuths.com has cracked the case, but we're still waiting.
Let's hope.
He's also trying to gather some of his friends from that era to come and look, too, and see what they think. And all of this is based on Carl's reconstruction, too. They're all looking at that. It's just we're just so blessed to have Carl Kay.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
This is all so intriguing. You guys got to go check it out. In fact, I was going to talk about this last week, and we didn't have the show. So instead of putting up a new one for the new one for this week, I wanted to tell you guys about this one. So please go to www.webfoos.com, and in the upper right-hand corner, you'll see that picture of Andrea Doe that Carl Kay made, along with a link to the thread. And maybe you'll be the one that recognizes her, but only if you're a member of Web Sleuth. So please join today. And Tricia, how much does it cost to join WebSleuth.com?
Oh, my flippin' heck. It's absolutely free. We just need an email address. It's very simple to do. Kimster, thank you so much for all of your great work. We'll get right on that cold case, and just maybe we might break it. It could happen. It's Tricia's True Crime Radio, brought to you today by Canines with a Cause. It's a nonprofit organization with the mission of helping shelter dogs find homes by training them to work as companion, therapy, and service dogs for veterans. Check out their website at caninswithacause.com. Opinions expressed on Tricia's True Crime Radio are those of the host and the guests. And as always, you know I take no responsibility for them. This radio show is a completely different entity and stands on its own from WebSleuths.com, LLC, and ForumsForJustice.org. So if you get your panties in a wad about something I said, blame me and not the forums. It's Tricia's True Crime Radio, where we discuss current events and true crime, and we always do it with common sense. Good night, everybody.